This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. Russia claims to have captured Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine after a nearly three-month siege that left over 20,000 civilians feared dead. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu declared what he called a complete liberation of Mariupol and of the Azovstal steel plant in the port city. The plant was the last stronghold of Ukrainian resistance. There was no immediate confirmation from Ukraine. Russian state media claimed over 2,400 Ukrainian fighters who had been holed up in the steel mill had surrendered. As they surrendered, the troops were taken prisoner by the Russians, and at least some were taken to a former penal colony. Others were said to be hospitalized. I'm Karen Chamas.
On Saturday, President Zelensky told reporters that Ukraine needs to become a full candidate to join the European Union rather than signing up to the kind of broader European political community proposed by the president of France. Zelensky called such a deal a compromise. Ukraine would have to meet rigorous standards in governance and fight corruption before it could be admitted as an EU member. French President Emmanuel Macron raised hackles in Ukraine on May the 9th by suggesting that the country could take decades to become a full EU member and should aspire instead to join what he called the European political community. Russia invaded Ukraine in February in part to thwart Kyiv's tilt toward integration with the EU and NATO. Macron's European political community initiative will be debated at an EU summit in late June. Macron has suggested that Britain, which left the EU after a referendum, could also join such a grouping. You can keep up on all the discussion about the EU and Ukraine at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday. Partial results show the opposition Labour Party is set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule. Partial results showed Morrison's Liberal National Coalition had been punished by voters in Western Australia and affluent urban seats in particular. Labour has yet to reach the number of lower House seats required to form a government alone. Final results could take time as counting of a record number of postal votes is completed. A spokesman for Thailand's negotiating team has told VOA its just-ended truce with the insurgents in the country's deep south is a success. The spokesman said Thailand hopes to settle the rules of a long-term ceasefire by the end of the year. Ethnic Malay Muslim rebels in Buddhist-majority Thailand are fighting for independence for the country's three southernmost provinces. Over 7,300 people have been killed in the fighting since violence flared up last in 2004 and the government imposed martial law over the region. The top U.S. military officer is challenging the next generation of Army soldiers to prepare America's military to fight future wars that may look little like the wars of today. Army General Mark Milley is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His remarks were for graduating cadets at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. His address painted a grim picture of a world that is becoming more unstable, with great powers intent on changing the global order, and he told the cadets they will bear the responsibility to make sure that America is ready. Tesla and SpaceX Chief Executive Officer Elon Musk has met with Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro to discuss connectivity and other projects in the Amazon rainforest. The Brazilian communications minister arranged the meeting, saying he's seeking partnerships to bring or improve internet in schools and health facilities in rural areas. A new poll shows U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating dipped to the lowest point of his presidency in May, with deepening pessimism emerging among members of his own Democratic Party. Only 39% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's performance as president, this according to a poll by AP and the Center for Public Research. Overall, only about 2 in 10 adults said the United States is heading in the right direction or that the economy is good. Both of those numbers are down from about 3 in 10 a month ago. Our top story once again, Russia claims to have captured Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine after a nearly three-month siege that has left more than 20,000 civilians feared dead. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
I think that the problems that we are facing as a country, these are not mere problems between a ruling party and an opposition political party. These are problems of Ugandans.
Expectations are high as Ugandans await President Yoweri Museveni's nation address Sunday.
Government for the ruling party to have a negotiation, to have a dialogue with the opposition political party, specifically Chadema. So we are seeing them opening up. So let's go and see if they are really genuine or they are just doing a lip service. We can make a conclusion after meeting them.
Talks between Tanzania's ruling party and the main opposition party, Chadema, are set to begin at the end of the month.
The SME ministry, the new investments, such as the one which has come through with through FQM, are those that are going to cushion some of these early shocks that may be received while we stabilize the investment environment in Zambia.
And Zambia's Minister for Labor and Social Security says the administration is recruiting teachers and nurses before the end of the year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Expectations are high as Ugandans await President Yoweri Museveni's nation address scheduled for Sunday. Linda Nabusai, the special presidential press secretary, says President Museveni will address the nation about the economic situation in the country. The address, officials say, will be broadcast on television and radio stations as well as on social media platforms. It comes as opposition and civil society groups call on the government to resolve what they say are the escalating prices of goods and services. For analysis and expectations of the president's speech to the nation, I reached Godbertu Mushabi. He is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist.
In my view, there is nothing much that you can really expect that is new, given the conditions that we are facing. Secondly, we are a country that is deeply in debt. Our revenues are very low. Our budget is largely dependent on borrowing and foreign grants. Our tax-to-GDP ratio is just around 14% of GDP. So the government has no financial flexibility to be able to make any interventions of whatever nature to be able to ameliorate the problems that the population is facing. So I really don't have any much expectation that he would say anything new other than explaining the problems, which he does most of the time.
Well, some people are suggesting that since a lot of Ugandans have expressed concern about the sharp rise in goods and services in Uganda, it is just appropriate for the president to assure the nation about his government's plan to try to reduce the burden on the average Ugandan. They expect that the president will try to come out with some solutions to resolve their concerns. Your thoughts?
The current situation is very tough, Peter, to tell you. Right now we are in the school opening season. I know many parents who are going through a tough situation getting kids back to school. There are many, many kids right now that are not yet back in school because they can't pay fees. So the situation is very, very tough, I can tell you, because you see, for a country to have to expand the range of policy tools to intervene, it must have been organizing itself and planning for these kinds of eventualities. For Mr. Mseven's government is a government that runs a huge patronage network of elected and non-elected leaders. So he doesn't have the flexibility. Even if he wanted to do it, he doesn't have the flexibility to be able to make the kinds of interventions that would be needed to ameliorate the current situation that citizens are faced with.
Are you therefore saying Ugandans who are expecting him to talk about healthcare delivery, service delivery, apart from the pressures, which a lot of people are saying economies of every country is being impacted due to ongoing world events, and that it will be unfair to criticize the government for world events that have sharply affected the economy. They also talked about, they expect the president to talk about chief substitute to hike commodities. Your thoughts?
I totally agree that some of the causes, some of the commodity prices here are really triggered by the ongoing global events, the war in Ukraine, its impact on fuel prices. We know that Malaysia just changed its policy and saying it's adding it has to add value to its palm oil production, palm oil raw materials. So that means that you would have cooking oil in Uganda or anywhere around the world, the price is going up. So in other words, I can fully understand. I am only saying that the government should be in a position to mitigate the costs of school fees, mitigate costs of healthcare, mitigate costs of, you know, there are a range of things that you can do which are within our means than the global events that affect everybody.
Recently, we've seen a former main opposition leader and presidential candidate, Kizza Besigye, wanting to go on demonstration and to call on the attention of the government to resolve the escalating prices of goods and services in Uganda. Some are wondering why other opposition political parties are not joining him in this, since they have also been complaining about the sharp rise in commodities. What are your views about that?
I think that the situation in Uganda is a difficult situation. So first of all, so the reason you don't see people in Uganda protesting is not because they are happy of the situation. So you have to factor in the question of fear. Secondly, I think that the problems that we are facing as a country, these are not mere problems between a ruling party and an opposition political parties. These are problems of Ugandans.
Godbertu Mushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, talks between the ruling Chama Pinduzi and the main opposition Chadema are scheduled to begin at the end of the month. Analysts say the move signals a shift in policy of President Samia Suluhu Hassan to engage the biggest opposition party. It came after the president held talks with Freeman Mbowe, national chairman of the main opposition party, shortly after he was released from jail. Chadema petitioned President Hassan for a meeting to help ease political tensions in the East African country. For the latest development and expectations of the much-anticipated dialogue between the ruling CCM and the main opposition party Chadema, I read John Rema. The Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema.
Since when Freeman Mbowe was freed, he just went straight to the State House by the invitation of the President Samia Suluhu Hassan, and that's where we started initiating a dialogue between Chadema, the ruling party, and the government. And they have been there last week, again, for the same purpose, and they agreed that we have to form teams for dialogue. Chadema should submit a team of not less than 10 people, and the government and the ruling party will submit the team as well. So we are expecting to hold the dialogue at the end of this month between Chadema, the ruling party, and the government on the other side.
Chadema has been seeking to have a dialogue with the president for a long time. How do you feel about this acceptance to meet you, and what are some of the major issues that you seek to address?
It is true that we have been waiting since the year 2020, April, when Freeman Mbowe written a letter to the late President John Magufuli about the need to have a dialogue to discuss what transpired in the 2020 general election in the country. But Magufuli never responded until he died last year. So when Samia Suluhu Hassan, the new president, accepted that, we saw that as a new government wanting to have a dialogue with us. So it's a thing we have been waiting for so long. The major issues we are expecting to go and discuss is about The first issue is about what transpired in the 2020 general election, why that election was so badly rigged. But the other issue is the need to have a new constitution for the country. This is a major issue. And also we have proposed that we have to sit and discuss about the need to form a truth and reconciliation committee for the country, because so many things happened for the last 6 years during the Magufuli time. We have to bring these people together. So many people have suffered in this country, from political leaders, politicians, businessmen, farmers, even to the fishermen. So everybody, we want to bring this nation together. So those are the three major issues we want to talk to the president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, and not forget about the need to have an independent electoral commission, so that in the coming elections, we want to go back to the 2020 election where everything was rigged. So those are the main issues we are going to put on the table and discuss with the government and the ruling party on the other side.
If the government decides that a new constitution, as you are demanding, is a non-starter during the dialogue, will this be a dialogue breaker? Will this be a no-go area that without talking about the demand for a new constitution, the talks cannot proceed?
We are going to bring on the table a make-or-break issue when we are going to meet in the first meeting. So for the time being, I can't say which is going to be a make-or-break issue, but we are going to bring them on the table on our first meeting, so that if they will say that they don't want that, then it is a break from the very start. So for now, we have agreed on various issues which are make or break, but I can't reveal it right now. We are going to reveal it when we meet at the first meeting with the president and his team from the other side of the ruling party and the government.
What are your expectations ahead of the much anticipated meeting between the ruling party and your party?
We are expecting to have a dialogue, genuine one, because even the ruling party vice chairman, Abrahamani Kinana, has said that there is a need for the government, for the ruling party to have a negotiation, to have a dialogue with the opposition political party, specifically Chadema. So we are seeing them opening up. So let's go and see if they are really genuine or they are just doing a lip service. We can make a conclusion after meeting them.
Following the announcement that you will be meeting them, what were some of the reactions from members of your party?
Some members of our party, because they have been living in this situation of them being jailed, being sent to the police all the time, some of them doesn't see the genuinity from the other side. But the leaders are trying to tell them that let's give them an olive branch. If they'll break it, it's up to them and not up to us. So it is true that some of our members are upset about it, but let's wait and see.
John Mrema is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Zambia's Minister for Labour and Social Security says President Hakainde Hichilema's administration has implemented measures to recruit 30,000 teachers and 11,000 nurses before the end of the year. Brenda Tambatamba also says he has created an enabling business environment to encourage Zambians to invest as well as attract foreign investors in sectors of the economy, including mining. Her remarks follow President Hakainde Hichilema's call for a concerted effort to improve the operating environment of the mining sector. His call came during a speech at the annual African Mining in Durban recently held in Cape Town, South Africa. For more on the labor market in Zambia, I reached Brenda Tambatamba via Skype. She is Zambia's labor and social security minister.
The New Dawn government has immediately launched into the recommitment and getting back to the voters with the deliverable of jobs, and not just jobs, but meaningful jobs. And certainly, the larger population of those that are to benefit from these jobs are young people. At our first budget, the new Dawn government of His Excellency, the President, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, did announce the job, the first initiative, which was about sourcing funds to pick up on the backlog of recruitment for both the education and health sectors, the two critical sectors of service delivery, education and health. And pronouncements were made to the extent that about close to 44,000 jobs would be made available to ensure that there'll be an uptake from the numbers to begin to unclog the numbers of those who are coming out of college. And so that is the first practical, most practical thing a responsible government does.
You know, the mining industry employs a lot of Zambians, from the youth to the elderly. There are fears that the mining companies have been sacking or shedding employees. How do you respond to such concerns?
I think first and foremost, before I even jump to that particular one, I think it's important to see a government that is operating methodically, delivering on its commitments methodically. But the SME ministry, a small and medium enterprise ministry, a new ministry has been formed. And that too was meant to target the employment of the youth, upskilling them in entrepreneurship, for them to begin to become future employers or self-employers who become future employers. So that too is a mechanism combined with the CDF that has been put in place, an unprecedented quantum leap from somewhere 1.6 million kwachas to 25.7 million that has been unleashed, bearing in mind that this would create jobs through the SME enterprises that are being chaperoned, coached, and mentored through that new ministry, but at the front line in the rural areas that have been ignored for many, many years. The government of the president, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, has already put a cushion, buffer zone, ensuring that people have got an opportunity to create employment for themselves. So this is a social safety net. This is social security that is being provided to ensure that we're doing some things for ourselves before we start thinking about what the mining companies are going to provide. Any mining company that will let go people will have to come to this ministry and other relevant ministries like Mines Ministry, Commerce, and the three different ministries. We'll work with them to find the best way to be a corporate citizen that takes care that you do not throw out people without due attention of where they are going to go. So those who may come out of there, of those redundancies, we still have a social safety net, a social security package of what I've described here.
I was about to ask you about the president's speech at the Indaba, at the Mines conference. Now, specifically with what the president spoke about, how does that practically influence the job creation in Zambia?
FQM, you have heard amongst the announcements that have been made in South Africa. We have a corporate citizen that is on the Zambian mining industry scenario. They are running two mines, large scale. Two of the five large scale mines in Zambia are run by FQM. FQM has just announced the $1.3 billion to begin to reinvest, to expand, because of the good climate environment for investment that has been created by the new Dawn government. And that too is another port that will be able to assist us to take on, to absorb some of those who may be coming from some of those redundancies. So we, as a government, are well coordinated to track, monitor, and ensure that we manage those dynamics that are taking place, where there's some that are out of one window. We have windows that are open, tunnels that are open to absorb the other ones. So the CDF, the SME ministry, the new investments, such as the one which has come through with through FQM, are those that are going to cushion some of these early shocks that may be received while we stabilize the investment environment in Zambia.
Brenda Tambatamba is Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. European Union election observers say Zimbabwe risks having another disputed election next year unless it ensures the country's election body is independent of the government and ruling party. For VOA Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital Harare, free, fair elections are a condition that Western countries have set for lifting sanctions imposed for alleged election rigging 20 years ago.
Elmer Brook, the head of the EU Electoral Mission, told reporters Friday that as Zimbabwe prepares for next year's elections, it must amend its electoral laws so that all parties have a fair chance of winning at the polls. Brook and his team were assigned to Zimbabwe by Brussels to share their findings after their first visit to Zimbabwe during the July 2018 elections. In an interview with VOA, Brook, a German national, said the mission gave Zimbabwean officials 23 recommendations for genuine electoral reforms.
It has to do with an equal playing field, impartiality of media, equal treatment of the parties, the proper voters' registration. So there's multi-party liaison committee. There will be a proper conduct of elections. The conduct on election day, the transparency, and then counting and the collection of the counts to the final results. If that is transparent and clear and no loopholes, then is that the best way to have peace in a country? Because nobody can say there was something which was wrong with the elections. To get credibility of election.
Zimbabwe officials would not comment Friday on Brooks' statement. Earlier though, Rafael Faranisi, the acting permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Foreign Affairs Ministry, said the government is looking forward to June 7 when Harare and Brussels officials meet.
This will be yet another opportunity to candidly assess progress to date and plan for the future based on realistic expectations. I've heard the concerns expressed with respect to developments in Zimbabwe, but I just wish to put it at record that in terms of the reforms that we've carried out, the challenge is, I just want you to give me 3, 4, 5 countries on our continent that have really done better than us. For those who have been following closely developments in Zimbabwe, we are on that reform trajectory and it's not reversible.
For years, Zimbabwe's elections have been marred by violence, voter intimidation and allegations of rigging leading to disputed results. When President Emmerson Mnangagwa succeeded Robert Mugabe in 2017, Mnangagwa promised to improve how elections are held, but the opposition continues to accuse the ruling ZANU-PF party and the government of manipulating the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Claudine, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the political pressure group concerned Nigeria for the protection of human rights and rule of law has petitioned Western embassies to impose a ban on prominent Nigerians who promote religious intolerance. The group says that includes those who have publicly supported the recent murder of Deborah Samuel for alleged blasphemy. Samuel was a student of Shehu Shagari College Education in Sokoto, Northwest Nigeria. She was killed and her remains torched by students for allegedly making a statement described by her attackers as blasphemy against the Prophet Muhammad. Her killing drew sharp condemnation from President Muhammadu Buhari, Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, and a host of prominent Nigerians and religious leaders. Civil society and political parties are demanding the prosecution of those responsible for Samuel's death. For more on the petition to the Western embassies, I reach Deji Adeyanju. He is the convener of Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law.
The confession is the supreme law of the country. Several courts all over the country said any other law that is made in contravention or in conflict with the Constitution, that law will be null and void. You know, so the spirit and the Constitution means, you know, the beginning and end of all laws in Nigeria. So that is the foundation of our petition, to say that, you know, this whole idea of escalating the alleged blasphemy and taking the laws into the hands by the perpetrators of our killers was wrong. Then those who have come to give life and justification for it, that there must be consequences for that bad behavior. You know, and this is the long perceived notion by some people that it is right and just to take the law into your hands.
How many foreign missions did you send or did your group send these petitions to? And why are you singling out those two? Because some people argue that a number of people from the north have come out in support of the attack on Ms. Samuels.
So if you look, our petition is supported by the media publications. You know, so we relied on the media publication. We gained a lot of followership and interest to base our petition. That is why we told the embassy, we said, attached is the evidence of their support and the reactions it has generated. You know, so that's just the only reason, nothing else.
Some people are saying your petition undermines the very constitution that you say you are protecting, because the constitution guarantees freedom of speech. So if they are expressing their freedom of speech, why call on foreign embassies to clamp down on them, they argue? What is your response to that?
Yes, you see, if you put Section 10 in the face of Section 36, you know, and yeah, Section 36 guarantees the freedom, but you can see what Section 36, what the omnibus clause says, that there are certain exceptions to all the fundamental rights enshrined in Chapter 4. You know, the exceptions are simple. The exceptions are that, you know, in terms of public health, public safety, public morality, you know, also issue of protection of other persons, other people, you know, then issue of, for instance, maybe there's COVID, you know, movements are restricted. So those are the issues, the simple issues. Nobody is saying they do not have the right to express their views. However, we are saying that by expressing and supporting her mother, you know, what they are simply doing is they are giving impetus to the act, which is wrong, which even the president himself has condemned. You understand? And neither are we saying whether the alleged blaspheming was true, or whether we are saying that the alleged blaspheming was justified. No. We are saying the law should have allowed to take its course. People should not come and justify jungle justice, which is what the president condemned, which is what we are condemning. And we are saying these people ought to have known. They ought to have known better, you know, and these kind of things is capable of getting many people to engage in jungle justice, and there will be many more victims.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Cameroon's National Day on May 20 has been marked by running battles between government troops and separatists who impose a lockdown, crippling businesses in English-speaking Western regions. The military says at least 28 separatists who vowed to disrupt celebrations in English-speaking regions of the majority Francophone nation were killed in violent battles. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, where President Paul Biya is attending commemorations.
Cameroon's military sings at a ceremony to commemorate May 20 in the capital, Yaoundé, pledging loyalty to state institutions and expressing the readiness of troops to defend the country's territorial integrity. The government said the parade marking Cameroon's 50th National Day was attended by at least 30,000 civilians led by President Paul Biya. The government said it reduced the time for the military parade to 45 minutes for strategic reasons. However, opposition political parties, including the Social Democratic Front, said the ailing 89-year-old Biya could not stand up for 2 hours to honor the military during its parade, as has been the tradition in Cameroon. The government said the National Day celebration was successful in Cameroon's French-speaking regions. Separatists said they imposed a lockdown in English-speaking Western regions to protest May 20 celebrations, also known as the Day of National Unity between the English-speaking minority and the majority French-speaking nation. Capo Daniel is Deputy Defense Chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, which Cameroon officials call a leading separatist group. He says fighters stopped government troops from transporting French speakers to English-speaking Western regions to give the impression that English speakers are happy with the central government in Yaoundé. Capo says in the process, many government troops were killed.
Previously, we have seen the Cameroon government drive into our territory, our own citizens, to stage public celebration of the 20th May. For this year, 2022, we have targeted Cameroon forces, killing over 24 of them. Across Ambazonia, our forces have signaled their presence to our population by firing shots in the air to send a message that today everyone should stay at home and observe a rejection of the Cameroon union with Ambazonia.
Ambazonia is what separatists call the state they say they are fighting to create. The government has denied its troops were transporting French speakers to English-speaking regions. The military says it lost 6 troops in battles within the past week and that 28 separatists who tried to disrupt May 20 activities were killed in several northwestern towns, including Oku, Kumbu, Bamenda, and Kambe. Colonel Samuel Talbot Orok is a commander of government troops fighting separatists in Bamenda, the capital of Cameroon's English-speaking northwest region. Orok says the military made sure everyone who came out for celebrations was protected.
Let the world, and Cameroon in particular, understand that the military in Bamenda know that the secessionist fighters will be doing everything in their powers to disrupt the successful 20th May celebration. That's why we are taking every single measure, as far as security is concerned, to make sure there is a hitch-free 20th May celebration in Bamenda.
Orok said running battles between government troops and separatists crippled activity in many northwestern towns and villages. The government said prior to the day, at least 35 people, separatists suspected of preparing to commemorate the day, were abducted by separatists in several towns of the southwest region, including Mutengene and Tiku. Bernard Okalia Bilai, the governor of the southwest region, spoke by telephone from Boya, capital of the region. Bilai says local administrative authorities and civilians report separatists who abduct and threaten to kill people accused of disrespecting lockdown calls to the military. He says civilians have understood that separatist claims that fighters can create an independent English-speaking state in Cameroon are unfounded. On May 20, 1972, Cameroon organized what it called a constitutional referendum, during which a majority of its citizens voted to abolish the federal system of government that had existed since 1961 in favor of a unitary state. Separatists say there has been an overbearing influence of French in English-speaking Western regions since the 1972 referendum. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
On Instagram we met, we come to tell lovers, we come exchange number. Super. As if that day go like this, that day start something, yeah. A very big something, for real, for real. So baby come let me protect ya, and I go try not to offend ya. For you a tiny to command, no. I know be tough ready come and go. You need come back at your talk when you say, I could choose and talk to better. Only if you want to be tango. But you could look at my mambo. Cause you're going to say, let's do this. Oh,
Centrafrique aujourd'hui. Africa ezali continent kitoko. Africa ezali mabele ya bakoko batika. Bino bato bozali banai boya kotala Africa. Boya na continent Africa bokokuta biloko nyonso ezali. Bakoloba bakotonga Africa e. Africa donyo pa mimi kasi ezali na nyonso eliba oe.
paid. When we say papa, you say oh yeah.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Said Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, leaves never fall into a boat that is always moving. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.